You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. During a recent progressive gathering in Washington, D.C., where activist social critic Jim Hightower spoke about the duty to dissent, the patriotism of activism, and the power of trickle-up politics, Peace Watch producer T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet, spoke with those in attendance about how public opinion has shifted noticeably to the right. He asked the progressives present if it's likely to swing back to the left. Hightower himself had a lot to say on the subject.
The sense that something is going on in America of grassroots people wanting to take power back. And as I travel, you know, going to about every place that's got a zip code, I'm getting this response of people who already have a grassroots movement going in America. We don't have to create it, a progressive movement. But it's not been connected up much before. And people are yearning, reaching out, and finding ways that we might bring power back to the grassroots, because we now know that the forces of regression, autocracy and plutocracy, are stealing our democracy from us.
That's the big concern that we all have. I mean, you watch what's going on, and I'm reading a history now, a history book, and it's like everything keeps repeating itself. It's kind of scary when you get right down to it. Because some of the things that have happened in history in the past, it's like you see the same kinds of things happening again. And I mean, that's what history is. It doesn't ever teach us anything. So it'll be interesting. This pendulum always swings back, but it's just a matter of when. And we're just hoping it's sooner rather than later.
Well, I got to tell you, I think it's going to swing back in the sense that we used to have, you know, the silent majority way back when. Yeah, there's swinging the way the pendulum's swinging now. I think there's certainly a silent majority out there right now that's saying they're not going to put up with a lot of what's going on with this current administration. They can see through the gimmicks we get on the economy, the gimmicks we get on the environment, and the fear-mongering that we get, you know, in terms of terrorism. And it's going to take a while. It's going to be a long fight.
Oh, boy, I'd sure like to believe so. These are hard times.
I don't think the pendulum's gone as far as it's going to go to the right, but once it gets there, it will swing back. The signal is going to be the indictment and imprisonment of several high-level political appointees.
I think that the president's actually gotten a pass with some of the tragedy that we face with 9/11, and there's some distraction with the war in Iraq. I mean, prior to that, you could see August 2001, the Bush administration was on the ropes when it comes to environmental policy. There was no hiding from it, and I think that we're going to emerge from that cocoon, give it a little more time.
I think the pendulum is probably getting close to as far right as it's going to go. I think that people are getting tired of what's going on in the administration right now, and I think it's definitely going to start moving back the other way.
Is there any kind of event you think is going to sort of spur it on?
Well, I'd hope that the elections, perhaps maybe the new Supreme Court appointees will really drive people to start getting involved with politics again and voting the other way.
I don't know. At some point, we have to deal with the consequences of this swing in the direction it went, and I hope they don't get so bad, and I hope that we realize that it swung the wrong way and we need to swing back. I think in totality, the place that we're going is, you know, we're heading in the wrong direction. I think that how many tax breaks for rich people can you give? How many breaks can you give for large corporations that are trying to destroy the environment and logging in our national forests and so on and so forth? I mean, at some point, I think people are going to understand that those that are in government right now are not representing them. So I just hope they understand that and come to that realization sooner rather than later.
I work for the federal government, and I know a lot of people in my own department are very upset by what's going on, and the political appointees are doing things that they're not happy with. I think if the economy doesn't turn around like he says it's going to, and I also think if they never find the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I think the people are going to be very upset by that, and that their boys are dying for nothing.
We need to keep his feet to the fire on that. You got to make sure to keep the feet to the fire on the weapons of mass destruction that were supposedly there.
And what's it going to take to swing the other way? I'm not sure about that. What do you think?
Actually, I think there's a good chance that Bush and his whole imperial adventure is going to come to ruin. I think the economy is in the toilet. And I don't think, even though he's pumping it up with a $400 billion deficit, we got a $500 billion trade deficit that cancels out that stimulus. You know, they're going to reach the bottom of how much they can lower interest rates to stimulate the housing market. and he hasn't created any jobs. He's going to be looking at that. They're bogged down in Iraq. There's like a major battle going on the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan that, you know, doesn't get any real news coverage, and we're bogged down there. His so-called roadmap to peace is in tatters. On top of that, you know, the rest of the world is pretty alienated. The Chinese and the Japanese, who are our creditors, are pissed off that, you know, we keep lowering interest rates and the dollar comes down. They're holding all these dollar-denominated assets, and they want that reversed. And that's some pressure on Alan Greenspan no one talks about. So, you know, Alan may not be able to bail Bush's tender ass out in the election year. And maybe he might go the way Bush 41 did. But I don't put it past these guys, who are the ultimate cynics. They're against democracy. They're really the incredible manipulators that we think they are, that to foment some sort of Gulf of Tonkin-style thing to get people to rally around the flag during the election year. That's the one thing I'm scared about.
Well, it depends on whose lifetime you're talking about. Probably not in my lifetime, but I've never seen it swing this far to the right ever. You happen to have chosen to speak to a pessimist. Now, you might want to go look for an optimist to even it out.
I'm naturally an optimist, so I would like to say yes, but at the moment it's looking awfully bad. I don't have much faith in the government, the present government. I think that they're making things worse rather than better.
Well, let's pray for a poor economy. I'm very serious, because if the economy bounces back, it's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough.
It's going to take some kind of progressive political organization. I would like to say a political party, but I don't know a political party that's ready to do it yet, to tap into the great strength in the grassroots people of this country. I'm a lucky duck because I get to travel the country and don't have to get my information from the establishment media. And I see that what the political establishment, what the media establishment, what the corporate establishment is saying about America is not actually true. That's not what Americans believe. And so people are building something that is important at a grassroots level. And if we can connect that up and give it a national focus, we'll take power back in this country. The people are ready.
Humorist Texan Jim Hightower, in attendance at a recent lecture in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Theater. The segment was produced by T. of the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Finally tonight, we turn to writer and columnist Tom Hartman. His recent article entitled When Democracy Fails, The Lessons of History is read by Christopher Sprinkle of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Welcome to Mr. Sprinkle's Monday Morning Lullaby. I'm Mr. Sprinkle. Joining me on the guitar is my friend Cuddly Dudley, or to those of us who know him best, the constantly repeating single refrain playing guitar player. Before I begin this week's story, grab yourself a nice thick sweater or a warm blanket and sit back and get all snuggly warm on your couch or in bed with a hot cup of cocoa, and just listen. This week's story is When Democracy Failed, The Warnings, by Tom Hartman. The 70th anniversary wasn't noticed in the United States and was barely reported in the corporate media. But the Germans remembered well that fateful day 70 years ago, February 27th, 1933. They commemorated the anniversary by joining in demonstrations for peace that mobilized citizens all across the world. It started when the government, in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services knew, however, that the odds were he would eventually succeed. But the warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. He was a simpleton, some said, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and did not have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalistic rhetoric offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. And, as a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and bizarre initiation rituals that involved skulls and human bones. Nonetheless, he knew the terrorist was going to strike. Although he did not know where or when, and he had already considered his response. When an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was ablaze, he verified it was the terrorist who had struck and then rushed to the scene and called a press conference. "You are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," he proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out building, surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning." He used the occasion, a sign from God, he called it, to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors. People, he said, traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in Orionburg to hold the first suspected allies of the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail and wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. To get his patriotic decree on the protection of people and state passed over the objections of concerned legislators and civil libertarians, he agreed to put a 4-year sunset provision on it. If the national emergency provoked by the terrorist attack was over by then, the freedoms and rights would be returned to the people, and the police agencies would be re-restrained. Legislators would later say they hadn't had time to read the bill before voting on it. Immediately after passage of the Anti-Terrorism Act, his federal police agencies stepped up their program of arresting suspicious persons and holding them without access to lawyers or courts. In the first year, only a few hundred were interred, and those who objected were largely ignored by the mainstream press, which was afraid to offend and thus lose access to a leader with such high popularity ratings. Citizens who protested the leader in public, and there were many, quickly found themselves confronting the newly empowered police's batons, gas, and jail cells, or fenced off in protest zones safely out of earshot of the leader's public speeches. In the meantime, he was taking almost daily lessons in public speaking, learning to control his tonality, gestures, and facial expressions. He became a very competent orator. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, he brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride among his countrymen, so instead of referring to the nation by its name, he began to refer to it as the homeland. As hoped, people's hearts swelled with pride and the beginning of an us-versus-them mentality was sown. Our land was the homeland, citizens thought. All others were simply foreign lands. We are the true people, he suggested, the only ones worthy of our nation's concern. If bombs fall on others, or human rights are violated in other nations, and it makes our lives better, it's of little concern to us. playing on his new nationalism and exploiting a disagreement with the French over his increasing militarism, he argued that any international body that did not act first and foremost in the best interest of his own nation was neither relevant nor useful. He thus withdrew his country from the League of Nations in October 1933 and then negotiated a separate naval armaments agreement with Anthony Eden of the United Kingdom to create a worldwide military ruling elite. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, "Gott mit uns," God is with us. And most of them fervently believed it was true. Within a year of the terrorist attack, the nation's leader determined that the various local police and federal agencies around the nation were lacking the clear communication and overall coordination administration necessary to deal with the terrorist threat facing the nation, particularly those citizens who were of Middle Eastern ancestry and thus probably terrorist and communist sympathizers and various troublesome intellectuals and liberals. He proposed a single new national agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agencies under a single leader. He appointed one of his most trusted associates to be leader of this new agency, the Central Security Office for the Homeland, and gave it a role in the government equal to the other major departments. His assistant, who dealt with the press, noted that, since the terrorist attack, radio and press are at our disposal. Those voices questioning the legitimacy of their nation's leader or raising questions about his checkered past had by now faded from the public's recollection as his Central Security Office began advertising a program encouraging people to phone in tips about suspicious neighbors. This program was so successful that the names of some of the people denounced were soon being broadcast on radio stations. Those denounced often included opposition politicians and celebrities who dared speak out. A favorite target of his regime and the media he now controlled through intimidation and ownership by corporate allies. To consolidate his power, he concluded that government alone was not enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for wars overseas. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation, particularly those previously owned by suspicious people of Middle Eastern ancestry. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got the lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center for enemies of the state. Soon more would follow. Industry flourished. But after an interval of peace following the terrorist attack, voices of dissent again arose within and without the government. Students had started an active program opposing him, later known as the White Rose Society. And leaders of nearby nations were speaking out against his bellicose rhetoric. He needed a diversion, something to direct people away from the corporate cronyism being exposed in his own government, questions of his possibly illegitimate rise to power, and the oft-voiced concerns of civil libertarians about the people being held in detention without due process or access to attorneys or family. With his number two man, a master at manipulating the media, he began a campaign to convince the people of the nation that a small, limited war was necessary. Another nation was harboring many of the suspicious Middle Eastern people, and even though its connection with the terrorist who had set afire the nation's most important building was tenuous at best, it held resources their nation badly needed if they were to have room to live and maintain their prosperity. He called a press conference and publicly delivered an ultimatum to the leader of the other nation, provoking an international uproar. He claimed the right to strike preemptively in self-defense, and nations across Europe, at first, denounced him for it, pointing out that it was a doctrine only claimed in the past by nations seeking worldwide empire, like Caesar's Rome or Alexander's Greece. It took a few months, an intense international debate and lobbying with European nations, but after he personally met with the leader of the United Kingdom, finally a deal was struck. After the military action began, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain told the nervous British people that giving in to this leader's new first strike doctrine would bring peace for our time. Thus Hitler annexed Austria in a lightning move, riding a wave of popular support as leaders so often do in times of war. The Austrian government was unseated and replaced by a new leadership friendly to Germany, and German corporations began to take over Austrian resources. In a speech responding to critics of the invasion, Hitler said, "Certain foreign newspapers have said that we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say, even in death, they cannot stop lying. I have, in the course of my political struggle, won much love from my people. But when I crossed the former frontier into Austria, there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators." To deal with those who dissented from his policies, at the advice of his politically savvy advisors, he and his handmaidens in the press began a campaign to equate him and his policies with patriotism in the nation itself. National unity was essential, they said, to ensure that the terrorists or their sponsors did not think they'd succeed in splitting the nation or weakening its will. In times of war, they said, there could be only one people, one nation, and one commander-in-chief. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. And so his advocates in the media began a nationwide campaign charging that critics of his policies were attacking the nation itself. Those questioning him were labeled anti-German, and it was suggested they were aiding the enemies of the state by failing in the patriotic necessity of supporting the nation's valiant men in uniform. It was one of his most effective ways to stifle dissent and pit wage-earning people, from whom most of the army came, against the intellectuals and liberals who were critical of his policies. Nonetheless, once the small war annexation of Austria was successfully and quickly completed, and peace returned, voices of opposition were again raised in the homeland. The almost daily release of news bulletins about the dangers of terrorist communist cells wasn't enough to rouse the populace and totally suppress dissent. A full-out war was necessary to divert public attention from the growing rumbles within the country about disappearing dissidents, violence against liberals, Jews, and union leaders, and the epidemic of crony capitalism that was producing empires of wealth in the corporate sector but threatening the middle class's way of life. A year later, to the week, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. The nation was now fully at war, and all internal dissent was suppressed in the name of national security. It was the end of Germany's first experiment with democracy. As we conclude this review of history, there are a few milestones worth remembering. February 27, 2003, was the 70th anniversary of Dutch terrorist Marinus van der Lubbe's successful firebombing of the German Reichstag, or Parliament building. The terrorist act that catapulted Hitler to legitimacy and reshaped the German constitution. By the time of his successful and brief action to seize Austria, in which almost no German blood was shed, Hitler was the most beloved and popular leader in the history of his nation. Hailed around the world, he was later Time magazine's Man of the Year. Most Americans remember his Office for the Security of the Homeland and its Schutzstaffel simply by its most famous agency's initials, the SS. We also remember that the Germans developed a new form of highly violent warfare they named Lightning War, or Blitzkrieg, which, while generating devastating civilian losses, also produced a highly desirable shock and awe among the nation's leadership, according to the authors of the 1996 book, Shock and Awe, published by the National Defense University Press. Reflecting on that time, the American Heritage Dictionary left us this definition of the form of government the German democracy had become through Hitler's close alliance with the largest German corporations and his policy of using war as a tool to keep power. Fascism. A noun. A system of government that exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership, together with belligerent nationalism. Today, as we face financial and political crises, it's useful to remember that the ravages of the Great Depression hit Germany and the United States alike. Through the 1930s, however, Hitler and Roosevelt chose very different courses to bring their nations back to power and prosperity. Germany's response was to use government to empower corporations and reward the society's richest individuals, privatize much of the commons, stifle dissent, strip people of constitutional rights, and create an illusion of prosperity through continual and ever-expanding war. America passed minimum wage laws to raise the middle class, enforced antitrust laws to diminish the power of corporations, increased taxes on corporations and the wealthiest individuals, created Social Security, and became the employer of last resort through programs to build national infrastructure, promote the arts, and replant forests. To the extent that our Constitution is still intact, the choice is again ours. Tom Hartman is the author of over a dozen books, including Unequal Protection and The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. You've been listening to Mr. Sprinkle's Monday Morning Lullaby. I'm Mr. Sprinkle.
Special thanks to KPFK's Christopher Sprinkle for producing that piece. To read Tom Hartman's commentary, visit his website at www.tomhartman.com. That's www.tomhartman.com. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T. from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hammond of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.